You're listening to the Broadway Podcast Network.
From Shakespeare to Schwartz, from Fosse to Alvin Ailey, from Sondheim to Bareilles, from McNally to Fay, it happened to the greats, it still happens every day. When lightning strikes, it's the moment you know. When lightning strikes, where you're meant to go. You can stand and shout Eureka, do whatever you like. You'll never forget the moment when lightning strikes.
Hello, welcome to When Lightning Strikes, the podcast when artists talk about the moment they knew they had to choose this path. And my guest today is the extraordinary, totally nominated Alika Larson. Can you talk about your lightning strikes moment in your life?
Sure. I think mine was pretty early. I have 9 brothers and sisters, and 6 of them are adopted from all over the world. So we were sort of this rainbow-colored family. And everywhere we went, like in our town, we were like everybody knew who the Larson family was because we were so unusual. I mean, it's unusual now, but it was particularly unusual, the interracial adoption and international adoption back in the 70s and 80s when I was growing up. And so everywhere we went, we were the Larsons, and I was one of the Larsons, and nobody knew my name because 10 kids, how could you? And I was really desperate for individual attention. And my mom thought we were the multicultural Von Trapp family, and every Christmas she would make us perform at her Christmas party. And so that was where my lightning strike was. I looked forward to my big solo every year more than I looked forward to Christmas presents. Like I would start thinking like September, October, what's my big number going to be this year? So really it was like in front of the fireplace by the Christmas tree, in front of, I don't know, 100 of my parents' friends that really like they clapped for me. And I thought, oh, I want more of this.
Do you remember what some of the things you sang? And was there one particular concert where it really gelled for you?
Maybe, probably I was about 7. I don't know. And I remember that it was a song, and I'm not actually sure I've ever heard this song anywhere ever since, but it went, I believe in Santa Claus, I believe in him because, and I'm not sure how anything after that, but I just always, that's sort of, when I think back, that sort of epitomizes, and I had a very adorable little red dress on, like a red plaid dress with lace on the bottom. That's the image I have in my head of that moment. Well, I was seen and valued, you know, and it wasn't that, you know, my parents were very loving and we all got our love and attention, but yes, getting to step out from the, here's the thing is, so we would do like that. My mom always typed out a program and like had to type it out multiple times because it was typing out on paper because we didn't have a computer. And so there was like a serious program in it. And we always would do a group number, like multiple group numbers, and then duos and or duets and trios. And I remember realizing it was a big deal that I got a solo. It was like my parents knew I could handle it. Like I had siblings who, I'm the only one who's a performer. My brother, actually, my oldest brother played the trumpet for the Chicago Symphony, but I was the only like performer. And so a lot of them just had no interest in really even maybe doing the concerts in the first place, really shy brothers and sisters. So my mom would sort of pair them up with somebody who could sing with them. And so I remember sort of it dawning on me that like I was a showman, you know, that I had what it took to step out on my own, that there was something different about me from the sort of crowd of my siblings.
Outside of that, do you remember one of the first times you were out when you were performing, whether it was for class play or you know, somewhere else outside the concerts?
Yes, I did in maybe the 5th grade. Mm-hmm. I played the professor in a play about grammar. It was something like I lost a verb or a pronoun or something. There was singing in it. I remember that. And I remember enjoying that and being very proud that I got a big part in it. I'm not sure it was the lead because I'm not sure it was a play anyone's ever heard of since. But I remember feeling very proud that I had an important part in that.
And you grew up, tell me if I'm right, in Cambridge, Massachusetts. Yeah. Is that right?
Yeah.
And you went to Yale. And did you, when did you really seriously start to study? say a theater performance?
Well, you know, I was always sure I could sing. That I felt confident about. But when I acted, I felt very uncomfortable because I wouldn't have used the word false, but I often knew I was being false. And I didn't know I just knew it felt wrong and I didn't know how to fix it. It didn't feel good to be doing it in the way that singing felt good to me. So I didn't like the way that felt. So I would avoid it. So I never would have thought that I would ever do like straight plays that didn't, I thought I'll just always do musicals because then I can sing really loud and no one will notice that I can't act. And then I got to high school, and my high school had an incredibly impressive drama department, like a drama program. And I remember my freshman year, I chickened out, and I didn't take drama class, and I didn't audition for anything. And this was somebody who was obsessed with theater, but I was so scared of that side of it. And finally, my dad said, Anika, take drama class. Just take it. And I did, and then I started auditioning for those plays, and I became one of the drama kids I was intimidated by. And so at that point, I knew I wanted to go to a college with a good theater program. I was always super pragmatic. I was very aware that it was a very unlikely thing that I would ever succeed in this business. I knew somehow I had heard and understood fully how hard a business it was, and how hard it would be to have a life in the theater. So I wanted to go and study theater in college, but I don't think I still thought I would ever end up doing it for a living. I'm sure I dreamed it, but I don't think I believed it. I still honestly sometimes don't believe it. It's nuts that I won the lottery and I get to do this thing that I love for a living. But so we didn't have the internet back then. I didn't know how to Google or find out like what were the good theater programs. I heard Yale had a good theater program. Looking back now, like it was the drama school that people were talking about. I didn't know that. But so I applied for undergrad and I applied early. So it was the only school I applied to. And very lucky for me, I got in because I didn't have a backup plan. And then when I got there, I majored in theater. And that was where I first took an acting class. And to my great relief, learned that there were tools, strategies, techniques to help me at the times that I was feeling false, help me to be honest on stage. And so that, I think, sort of gave me the confidence boost I needed to go and actually try to move to New York City and try.
And I think about just your voice alone. I mean, there are singers and then there are belters. Like, do you have a sense of when you knew you could belt like that you could sing with such ferocity?
I knew that I was obsessed with Annie when I was little, and I also knew that I was obsessed with Whitney Houston. And so I would say that for the past 40 years, I have been trying to sound like what it would sound like if the two of them had a baby. That's what I want to be. So that's always what I sort of modeled myself after, was belting and pop with a little bit of soul in it. That's the way I wanted to sound. And so, you know, it's Malcolm Gladwell's theory about 10,000 hours. If you spend 10,000 hours at anything, you can, like when we think of geniuses, they're not born that way. They've spent 10,000 hours doing that. So I've spent 10,000 hours trying to belt in this particular way. So thank goodness I'm good at it by this point. Otherwise, that's wasted many, many hours.
Yeah, I love that book with the Beatles and Hamburg and how they
exactly.
went.
Exactly. Yes. And Bill Gates.
But you had to have some kind of proclivity to sing. I mean, that to sing, right? It didn't just happen that you could. I know you had to develop that over time. Yeah. But and I know you talked about your Christmas.
I was trying to copy a sound I heard, and you know, and it got me places like through college, and then right after college, and when I got Rent. But a lot of what I was doing was yelling on pitch, which was not sustainable. certainly not 8 shows a week for all time. And certainly not now at 46 could I be yelling on pitch and belting the way I was back then. So I'm deeply grateful to Matt Farnsworth, who was my vocal coach for years and who I go to him if I have something sort of particularly difficult I want to work through. But I don't take regular voice lessons anymore. But he helped me find my mix. So for people who don't know, women, we have these two registers. We have our chest voice, which is like our talking voice, and then we have our head voice, which is like what sounds like opera, you know, singing like Marie and the Sound of Music. Do a dear, a familiar, a dear, as opposed to Annie's belting tomorrow, tomorrow. And those are two registers that are different for us. And in the middle is this sort of awful, evil, no man's land that they call your mix. And you have to, most people don't naturally have a great mix. And it's something you really have to work on. And so I did, you know, part of my 10,000 hours was really working with him on finding my mix so that it can be seamless from one of those registers to the other. And now my mix has gotten to the place where it sounds enough like a belt that I don't have to belt anymore. I just mix it and it's much easier. It's much more healthy. It's off my chords in a way that's not straining them and much easier to do 8 times a week and easier to do, like if I'm tired, my voice is tired, or if I feel like I have a cold coming on or something, or if I do have a cold, I have options now. I have ways that I can place it and navigate it in my voice that I absolutely did not have when I was, you know, 25 years ago.
Now, did you move to New York right after graduation? I saw that your debut, tell me if this is right, was in Rent.
It was. I did go home for a year and to wait tables and make enough money to, like, I just didn't have any money and I was scared to move to New York without any money. And I sometimes wonder if that was the right thing, but I suppose, who knows? It was the right thing for me. Yeah, so I moved to New York in the fall of 1996, and the big hot musical at that time was Rent. And I remember seeing it and thinking, God, they're good. I don't know how I could ever be that good. And like wearing out the double cassette tape of that thing. Like, that's how we rolled back then. Just playing that thing backwards and forwards and just all of it memorized. And so I auditioned for sort of absolutely everything I could that was listed in the back of Backstage. And I accepted all of the jobs I was offered, whether they paid or not. And none of them paid at that time. It was, so I was just like doing theater at night and working day jobs during the day. And each one of those experiences was like a class, like it was like my grad school that time. And then, yeah, after about a year and a half, I was at a temp job and it was a Tuesday and I got the call and they said, can you be in LA on Friday to be in the LA company of Rent the following Friday? And the answer is of course. So I packed up my life in 3 days, sublet my room in my apartment and flew out there. And thank goodness I knew the show backwards and forwards because I had a week to learn it. There was an incredible shift at some point in that week of rehearsing and getting to know all of these people who were real. I mean, I wasn't union before that. They made me union to do this. Was the first time I made a living wage, a salary, being an actor. And it was my first like real professional job. And so there was this magical thing that happened that by the time I was putting my costume on that following Friday night, I thought, hey, I belong here. I don't feel like an imposter. I'm good enough to be here. I can do this. I belong on this stage with all these incredibly talented people. I can do this. And that was an amazing shift for me. That ended up turning into the second national tour. And I did that and then came back to New York and they asked me to come to the Broadway company just for 2 months as a vacation swing. And I did that and I went on and I had my Broadway debut. That ended and I looked around and I said, all right, I'm a Broadway actor. Who wants to hire me next? Crickets. No one did for 2 years. I didn't get another job getting paid as an actor for 2 years. So I had to go back to the sort of hustle of working my day jobs and doing theater for free at night and forging relationships and learning a lot. And that was a super good lesson for me to learn really early on. It's just the feast or famine nature of this business. It's kept me humble, it's kept me hungry, and it's kept me smart about squirreling away my nets while I'm getting them, because who knows when you're going to need to dip into your savings at whatever point in your career.
What kept you going those 2 years, though, after you'll be on Broadway, touring the biggest musical, this such a key musical, and then you say crickets. What made you so intrepid?
You know, I'm not sure if it was intrepid as much as, because I've had droughts like that. I mean, I think we all do. I've had periods like that throughout my career. And, you know, I think of the business, a life in the theater. The image for me in my head is always like the graph of the NASDAQ, like the stock market, like that's going up and down and up and down. And it's always gradually going up, but there's highs and lows and plateaus when you can least expect it. And so that's sort of the life. And I think, honestly, it's not intrepidness as much as it's like, I just have never been able to figure out an exit strategy. I've just never been able to find something else I wanted to do enough that I could find the motivation to pursue it, you know? So it was just like, you keep cranking along, hoping. And when you're young, hope is not hard to come by. It's the later years that can start feeling more despairing. So I think that first, I mean, I think I was early enough career to feel sort of audacious at first and then be like, yeah, no, maybe this is just how what I deserve right now. I got to earn it. Got to pay my dues. I've never had a problem with paying my dues.
See, there's a great quote, the harder you work, the better your luck. My father used to tell me that all the time. Yeah. So,
yep. I know true story.
And you have the most phenomenal story about getting cast in Beautiful that I just love so much. Can you share that story about how Beautiful came to be in your life?
Yeah, so Beautiful, the Carole King musical, is indeed about Carole King's life. It's her life writing music in the 60s. And so her and her then husband, Jerry Goffin, were a songwriting team in this publishing house that was also the home of Cynthia Weil and Barry Mann, who were a couple and also a songwriting team together. And they were best friends and also incredibly fierce competitors, so much so that they would go on vacation together just so they could be sure the other team wasn't writing the next hit song for the Shirelles while they were relaxing on a beach. And so I got to play the wonderful Cynthia Weil, who's written some of the most fantastic pop songs of the 60s and then really all the decades since. I did the very first reading ever of Beautiful, and it was maybe 5 years before it got to Broadway, maybe even more, I'm not sure now. And then I did like two more developmental like workshops of the show, and then they did a fourth and they recast me. And so I you know, as devastated as I was, I let it go, because you have to find, if you're not able to find your own particular zen about loss and rejection and uncertainty in this business, you don't have the constitution for it, and you're not going to be able to hang in there with it. So I was sad, but I let it go. And then, I was having another one of those periods of drought where I hadn't worked on Broadway in a long time. I hadn't made like a living wage in a good while. And I had gone to my tax accountant and realized I'd made $16,000 the year before. And it's just like, you can't live in New York on that money. And it was just, and I'd had to dip into my savings, and that had felt like a failure. And it just was like, you know what? Maybe this isn't for me. This is a masochistic way to live, and I can't do it anymore. Maybe I just need to move on. And then my agent called and he said, Beautiful is finally going to Broadway and they want you to come for final callbacks. And I was like, oh God, I don't want to get my hopes up again about this thing. I knew how great the part was. I knew how wonderful Cynthia Weil was. I knew how much she suited me and I suited her, but I really thought they had moved on and that like the most of the team was like, we don't need Anika anymore. And then like one person was like, no, let's just bring her back in for final callbacks just to remember why we didn't want her. So I felt like it was sort of a waste of my time, but you can't say no to something like that. So I went in and I did my best and they were all very lovely and it was nice to see everybody in the room. I had such affection for all of them. And I walked out of there certain I hadn't gotten it, and I just couldn't take it. It was like, it took everything in me not to, like, heaving sob in the subway. I was like, just keep it together till you get to your stop. And I got out of my stop and I just ugly cried all the way home. And I just remember thinking, this cannot be born. It's an awful thing to get so close to something so wonderful and not be able to get it. I'm not doing this anymore. I'm done. I quit tomorrow. And I was about to turn 40, and I had wanted a family my whole life, and I had just gone through a breakup and there was no man in sight. And it just felt like nothing in my life is going right now. So I have to choose different. And so tomorrow I am going to I'm going to start, I don't know what I was going to actually do, but I'm going to find a normal people job where I don't have to worry about losing my paycheck or my health insurance. And I am going to have a baby on my own. And that is going to be the next chapter of my life. And maybe theater will come back to me, maybe it won't. But at my age, this is what it has to be about. So this is what I will do. And so I wept all night and mourned the life I thought I was going to have and wasn't going to now. And I got up the next morning ready to start sort of trying to figure out what my plan was for this new chapter. And my agent called and he said, "You got it." And I said, "I got what?" And he said, "You got beautiful." And I literally wasn't being coy. I had so like coping mechanism, defense mechanism to that thing so far to the back of my brain that I had forgotten about the audition the day before. And he said, "Beautiful." And I said, "But what? And he said, "It's going to San Francisco and then it's going to Broadway and it's yours." And I said, "You mean I'm going to San Francisco, but they could replace me for Broadway?" And he's like, "No, it's all one contract. You've got it. What are you doing?" And then I just started again, super ugly crying, just ridiculous, called my parents, like hysterical. They couldn't understand what I was saying. They were so worried for me because they thought something awful had happened because I couldn't get out that I had gotten it. And it turned my life around in a lot of ways.
I know there's the second part of this. Mm. Multi-layered story.
Yes.
So here you got it, the role.
Yes. So I'm like, this is going to turn my life around. And the first week of rehearsals, it's going great. And then day four, all of a sudden, I start getting these stomach pains in the afternoon. And I think it's gas. So I don't tell anybody. But by that evening, I was fainting in the entrance to the emergency room at Brooklyn Hospital. And I thought I had appendicitis. But hours later, they determined that it was my colon had flipped and twisted on itself. I had a congenital defect. I had a floppy colon. And so all of the food behind it was backing up. And if I didn't have emergency surgery to have that section of my colon removed, it would burst and I would die. So they're like, and it has to happen now. So that was bonkers. And I said, "Well, how long will it take to recover?" And they said 6 to 8 weeks. And I thought, well, that's the whole rehearsal through the run in San Francisco. I just lost this part again. And then I had to push that out of my mind and focus on sort of the task at hand. But then I woke up from the surgery and I thought, bump that. I am fighting for this part. There's no way I'm letting this out of my clutches without like the fight of my life. So 8 days later, with a belly full of staples, I lost 10 pounds in 10 days. I returned to rehearsals. They were just, the whole team was so lovely to me. The producers paid for a car service to take me to and from my house in Brooklyn to Midtown. I wouldn't have been able to do the stairs to get to the subway, never mind like the whole thing. And the creative team, the director and stage management didn't say anything to me, but they called me late every day and released me early so I wouldn't have to do a full day. And Jared Spector, who plays my husband in the thing, he would always have a chair waiting for me the minute we were done rehearsing so I could sit down. Cause I felt like I was going to faint at any minute. And I thought I was pulling one over on them, that I was fine. And like a year later, one of the stage managers said, "We knew you weren't fine. There was nothing fine about you." But slowly but surely I came back and I had my last staple removed the day before we flew out to San Francisco. And then one day during tech, I was running up a staircase for a quick change, and I thought, "Oh, I'm back. My body's back. I'm good." And then we had a wonderful run in San Francisco and came back and opened the thing here. And man, the tears I shed at Bows on Broadway on opening night, just thinking I really, really didn't think, like, there were times I doubted I would make it here, and how amazing that I did. And then the cherry on top of all of this, or really the most, this is all wonderful, but really the most wonderful aspect of all of Beautiful was that I complained too often to my dresser about the state of my love life. And one day during a quick change, she said, "Would you like to be set up on a blind date with a trumpet player named Freddie?" And I said, "I've never turned away opportunity. Certainly I will." And the day we recorded the Beautiful Cast album, I was feeling really optimistic about it. So I like to think that you can hear in my voice my excitement and anticipation. But I walked straight from the recording studio in Times Square over to B.B. King's that no longer exists on 42nd Street. And I watched Freddie play for an hour and a half with a Ray Charles tribute band. And he was fantastic. And I thought, He's really good at the trumpet. He's really sexy. I really hope we have something to talk about. And cut to 6 months later, I moved out to the suburbs with him and I was pregnant with our first little boy. And now we have two little boys, a four-year-old and a three-year-old, and we call them our beautiful boys because they only exist because of Beautiful the Carole King musical. So really, this show turned my life around in all of the important ways.
Praised by Lin-Manuel Miranda as the future of musical theater, SUFS creator Shayna Taub makes Broadway history as only the second woman to write the book, music, lyrics, and star in her own original new musical. Don't miss the much-anticipated Broadway debut of the singular artist that Forbes calls visionary and Billboard anoints as one of the most inventive voices in musical theater. SUFS, the original new musical from Shayna Taub, is now playing on Broadway at the Music Box Theater. Get your tickets today at SUFSmusical.com. The Outsiders on Broadway tells the story of finding where you belong when the world refuses to accept you. Based on Essie Hinton's beloved novel, featuring new music from Jamestown Revival and Justin Levine, and directed by Danya Taymor, Entertainment Weekly says that, with brilliant staging and some of the most captivating stage fighting currently on Broadway, The Outsiders has the power to inspire an entire generation. Get your tickets today at outsidersmusical.com.
It's the ultimate gift. And PSSSS, the show also gave you a Tony nomination.
It did. It did do that. Yes.
I was thinking about, I saw it early on, the beautiful early on. I remember when you just bounded in, you have this very dramatic entrance. And I thought, wow, who is that?
And I had a good entrance. Yeah.
It was, and then you sang that wonderful sort of impromptu song made up to Happy Days Are Here Again.
Exactly. Yeah. Let me show off my lyric writing skills to you. Yeah.
Yeah. And I just thought, wow, that's a great musical theater character.
Yeah,
and
it really was. She was a gift.
And what you're doing now is so phenomenal as well. I was really, truly inspired by your, not only your porch concerts, and also your commitment to giving back to communities all over the world. Can you talk about that?
Well, you know, the porch concerts came out of Freddie, my husband, who is, as I said, a trumpet player. He was reading about Italian musicians playing their instruments out their windows. And we both got misty at that thought, the thought that sort of art will not be stopped. It can't be like a government can try to oppress it or a pandemic can try and shut it down. It just, artists are going to make their art, and whether it's like floating out their windows or coming out the woodwork, it just, we can't stop doing the thing that we do. And so I thought, so let's do that. But wait, we have a porch. That makes more sense. And so we've been doing, we did our fourth one day before yesterday. It all depends on the weather. But it's basically, it's sort of, we just go out and we do, you know, they're super casual concerts for our neighbors on our street, and everybody stays, we stay 10 feet away from each other just to be extra safe. And it's just a way to, for all of us to feel a little bit of communion. We're so thirsty for community right now. And so it's all just a way for us to come together, and we get to perform and they get a little entertainment, and most everyone doesn't have anything else to be doing at that time. So it's really a special thing for all of us. And it's starting to spread through the neighborhood, the word of our porch concerts. But also I was watching yet another frontline worker, a nurse, just despairing on the news, just weeping about how overwhelmed and distraught they all are. And I felt like I'm not carrying my weight. It's being one of 10 kids. It's like I have this compulsive need to be a team player and do my part. And I just thought I need to be helping more. How do I go to nursing school in 3 days? How do I learn how to sew so I can make masks? What am I'm not doing enough. And then I thought, well, wait, all of us should be finding the ways that we can give back using our specific skill sets. because I feel like it's like a dam that's springing all these leaks, but they're very, very unique, different kinds of leaks. And each of us can plug all the different kinds of leaks with all of our different gifts. And so I watch my husband, who is also the band director at our local middle school, and I just watch how hard it is for him to try and teach the arts remotely right now. And I thought, well, that's something I can do. So I went on Stars in the House, Seth Rudetsky and James Wesley Stars in the House, and twice now I've pitched myself and basically said, I will do a Q&A with any educators out there who want their students to learn about like life in the theater and ask any questions they want about theater. I will do a Q&A with your class. And so I've been doing those for the past, I don't know, 3 or 4 weeks. I've done them 2 every day. And I've done not only schools, but like theater groups, lots of kids whose productions were about to open and shut down at the last minute. And they're also disappointed. I'm going to do a public library. I did a residential treatment center for adolescent boys with behavioral issues. It's become, and I'm going international. I'm doing Canada and the Netherlands. It's become this really extraordinary thing. And people thank me every time. And I say, no, this is as much for my spirits as it is for yours. I just feel like I need to be doing more. And if this means anything to you, then it means a lot to me. So
what was the experience like talking to the boys in the group home?
It was the one, honestly, that so far has meant the most to me, because when else would I have ever had the opportunity to do this? Like, I had to sign a confidentiality agreement to even because they zoomed me into their classroom. And, you know, so it just, and, you know, they're in another state. So there was no way at any other time in my life that I would have been connected with this particular group of boys. And they, and, you know, as their teacher emailed me afterwards, he said, they don't get a lot of opportunities. And he said, and this was a grand one. And I just started to weep, and they made me posters that said, thank you. And it was great. I mean, they asked a lot of the same questions as everybody else who's a teenager that I talked to asked, but, you know, but they just really did, because they were sort of farther away from New York City. There was a lot they didn't know or understand about the business. And I really do think it was enlightening for them in some ways, just to hear about the sort of insides of it that I could share with them. It was really incredibly meaningful. You know, just today I did one with kids in Iowa City. When I will never probably be in Iowa. Now that my touring days are over because I have kids, that's the likelihood of that ever happening is very small. So the reach that we have now, how lucky we are that we have this technology, that the capacity of it is just, there's such reach that we really can connect so far and so wide so easily, is just, it's a little breathtaking. So that's one thing I'm doing. And then to add on to that, Seth and James have asked me to take on a new project that I'm very excited about. So every Wednesday and Saturday afternoon, as part of their Stars in the House series, they do Plays in the House, which is Broadway people reading plays out loud over StreamYard. And now they're going to add on, we're going to do Plays in the House Junior on Sunday afternoons at 2, starting May 17th. And so it's going to be plays for young people by young people, all performed by teenagers or young adults, and plays that have been written for high school students or middle school students. And the idea is to sort of try and help drama teachers out there figure out how they can do theater with kids now in the age of who knows when, especially sort of, it's going to differ in all different areas, but who knows when we're going to be able to do large gatherings again. So this is a way that we can do theater now that's safe and actually potentially really exciting and innovative. So, and each time all of the Stars in the House series stuff benefits, most of it benefits the Actors Fund, but our particular episodes are going to all benefit each week a different organization that does something to help bring theater to underserved youth. So every week it will be different, and we'll talk about that organization each time. But so it's all a benefit, and everybody's donating their time and their energies. And the plays are really good, and the casts that we've already put together are so good. I'm so excited about it, and I'm so excited to be on the other side. I'm executive producing, I'm directing, I'm curating. It's really so fun and something I've never done and wouldn't be doing otherwise. So I feel like this at this point in time, this pandemic is this giant cloud over the world, and it's up to all of us to forge silver linings, like just to force them, to make them happen. We can do that. We can come out of this with silver linings if we all just make it something we think about doing every day, every week.
Oh, goodness. That
was a long answer.
But I just want to applaud you.
And the passion of it all, Gerald.
Sorry, I was too busy applauding.
I said I got swept up in the passion of it all.
I love your passion. I'm all about passion. A, how do people hear about it? B, what are the mechanics of it all, of your porch concert?
Sure. Well, we have like an email list for our neighborhood. I'm on a cul-de-sac, so that sort of makes the space somewhat finite. And we have a block party every year that somebody organizes who is not me. And so I had that email list. So I just sent it out, and then I knew there were people we were missing. And so I sort of made a point, but it's been spreading sort of down the street. And then now when the weather, because we only do it when the weather is nice, everybody's out walking, right? We all need to get out. And so people have literally just walked past and stopped going, what is this that's happening right here? And then the mechanics of it is just that Freddie happened to have like good speakers and his musician. So he had some stuff. It's not particularly nice. I don't even know what the mechanics of it all are. It's not particularly nice equipment, but it serves, and really mostly helps with like the stuff that's quieter to sing. Because I do love to back away from the mic and just belt so that everybody can hear my voice. Something beautiful about just a voice on your eardrums, just like sound waves on your eardrums straight from a throat, as opposed to having the sort of intermediary of the speakers and the microphone. But it's all Freddie just sets it up beforehand, and our kids are unruly. I don't know which, if you saw in that clip, but like they do not behave and they do not stop talking. And there's something so charming about that too. And then my oldest Key, he's 4, and he loves to sing. He thinks every microphone was meant for him. Like even my stepfather's memorial service, it ended and the stage was empty and he went up to the microphone and started belting New York, New York at the top of his lungs. Like he just thinks literally, I think he believes they're for him. So he has sung a song at every one of them, except our last one, the second to last one was sort of thrown together at the last minute and he didn't have a number. And he turned to me in the middle of the concert. He goes, "Mama, why am I not singing a song?" So I said, "Fair enough. You get a number every time if you rehearse it." So he sang "Summertime" in this last one, and then our youngest son Asha, in the middle of it, came out with an accordion. Totally, just accordion bombed his number. We all love it. It's part of the charm is that it isn't super professional, and it's all like waiting for sound cues and wishing we had a real sound guy. But no, there's something lovely in that too. And I also like really the reminder of how much work goes into an actual professional production, how there isn't any lag time. You can banter and it goes segues immediately into your song so gracefully in ways that it just doesn't on our porch concerts. But I think it's a nice reminder to people of sort of what, I mean, they're free, right? And so what you're paying for when you're paying for a concert is the sort of smoothness and the polish that you are not getting when you're watching our porch concerts.
And I love that it was inspired by how you saw other people giving concerts. I know you talked about it, two boys doing just with a cello.
Yes, I saw on the news. It was two little kids playing a cello on a porch for one elderly woman. She was their only audience. And it was just, it was so meaningful. It was on the nightly news. And it's just, it just goes to show you don't have to be professional musicians to do porch concerts. Everyone can do them and they mean something to everybody. So I sort of highly encourage anyone out there who has even a modicum of talent or desire to perform to bring it over to someone who might be alone or lonely, or just do it from your own porch and see who stops to listen. I think we all are hungry for that right now. That musical connection. Music is such a bridge that brings us all together across borders, across cultures, and across a pandemic.
Yeah, isn't that great? What experience does, how it's sustainable, and how exciting that you're in Almost Famous for people.
I know.
Let's talk about that. I remember the Cameron Crowe movie has a special place in my heart because he was a journalist for Rolling Stone at how old? 15, 16? I mean,
yeah, they didn't know how young he was when they called him to go out on tour. But his mom sure did, and she was not happy about it. But you let him go, to her credit. She let him go have the experience.
And so you're in the Broadway bound, Almost Famous, based on the movie, right? And what a cast, and also Tom Kitt is, well, I'll let you talk. You explain
it beautifully. Well, Tom Kitt writes the music for this. And because if you've seen the movie, you know how important the soundtrack is to that movie. So never fear. There are snippets of all the important songs throughout. And Tiny Dancer on the Bus is in there. Don't worry. But they're all sort of woven in and around Tom Kitt's music, which that's not really the music I know, that music of that time. It's set in 1973. And so that type of music is not stuff I knew very well. So when I started doing the workshops of the show, I had to go look in our score to read who wrote, because Tom had done such an unbelievable and a beautiful job of writing songs that felt like they were of the time and so matched the music that was music from the time, that I was like, this one was written by David Bowie. I didn't realize this one was written by Tom Kitt. Fantastic. It was just, so he's done an amazing job with the writing and partnered so well with Cameron, who is writing the book and is there in the room with us all making it happen. And then they're co-writing the lyrics, and the lyrics are stunning. I mean, it's just, I can't say enough about how much I love this show and how excited I am about it and how much I think people are going to be so ready for it, because it's a musical that's about music being a necessity, but that it brings us together and that it creates family, and it's about isolation and it's about community and it's about needing each other and needing to find your tribe. And there's literally a song called Everybody's Coming Together, and boy, are we going to be ready to come together. So I think that it's going to be right on time when Broadway reopens. I'm so excited.
I'm excited. And you play, as we said, the Cameron Crowe, his mother,
Frances McDormand, did it in the movie. And I hadn't seen the movie when my agent called and told me about it. But Frances McDormand is my favorite actress of all time. So I was like, yeah, if it's her role, I'll do it. Yes, I'm in. And then I watched it. And of course, it's like, this is fantastic. And then, you know, I've really found that since then that there's something sort of serendipitous. There's this kismet around this thing and motherhood for me, because I know I could not have played a mother as well 5-6 years ago before I was a mother. It's so easy, especially as the mother of sons, to be the mother to this son. It's just say the words and get out of the way, and the emotion's there. It's so beautifully written that there's just like no work to be done. Knowing what I know and feeling what I feel for my little boys, it's all so easy and so beautiful. And the idea of returning to Broadway, playing the mother and being the mother for the first time. I haven't been a mother. Well, for 6 months, I'm beautiful. I came back and I had my oldest was between 3 and 9 months. But I've not been a mother to human beings that can run around and take from me all of the energy that they take from me, and two of them. So to go back and be the mother and figure out how to do the work-life balance of being a mom on stage and a mom off stage is a task I am so excited about and ready for. And this team, all of the producers from the get, have been so supportive of me being a mother. Stage management, the creative team, they all are so understanding. Like, of course, it's Mother's Day. Of course, you should have the day off to go to your little boy's preschool Mother's Day ceremony. Like, there's just... they're just so lovely about not using my time when they don't need me, because they know I could be at home with my kids and not paying for childcare. And also just the size of this role right now is so perfect for my life right now, because I have 3 amazing songs and some great scenes. And then for the bulk of the show, I am backstage knitting. And that is all I have the bandwidth for right now, because a 4- and a 3-year-old are relentless. And I just couldn't, with 2 small kids at home, be, you know, the main lead of something, singing eight songs and carrying the weight of the whole show on my shoulders. I just couldn't do that and like survive. It would just be such a poor choice for me to try and take on something like that right now. So for this show where I'm playing the mother to be so supporting me being able to be a working mother, it's just so magical. It's just been such a gift to my life. And I really just can't wait to get back to it.
Knowing what you know what it's like now, having two children, which I think is hard enough, right? Mm-hmm. Knowing what you know now, what was one of the most sort of surreal moments looking back of your childhood being part of 10 children? Was it brushing your teeth time, bedtime? Going to an event, just I'm thinking again, yeah. Going to, sure. You know.
Yeah, we traveled so much. How did we travel? How did you go to an airport with 10 kids? How did you not lose at least one of them in customs? It's just, so much of it is. But you know what, actually, one of the things that I really, I look back on it and it makes my heart feel full in a way that's really almost overwhelming and lovely is that my parents used to have, because it wasn't always that there were 10 kids in our house. There was actually only one year that there were 10 kids in the house. My oldest brother was a senior in high school and there was a teeny baby. But for the most part, it was like 7 or 8 of us in the house. And I remember when we were little, there was a time when there was exactly 7 of us and each of us would have a night to stay up. And that's what you called it. It's your night to stay up. Whose night to stay up is it? And I think we only got to stay up like an extra half an hour, but it was one-on-one time with our parents. It was a special treat. You got to watch TV while everybody else was sleeping and feel smug about that. And I just think what an ingenious thing for them to have thought of. And I'm going to do it with my kids, even though there's 2 of them and they get plenty of one-on-one time with us. But I just thought like just something about that I find so sweet, so lovely. And I just know how much it meant to me and how special it was to me. Well, another thing that was really special for me because it was so hard to find one-on-one time with my parents was my father is the only one in my family who sees theater I'm not in. Everybody else only goes because they have to when I'm in it. And he subscribes, so he's still up in Cambridge and he subscribes the ART. And he told me when I was little, if there's any show that tours through Boston that you want to see, I will take you. And those memories are some of the most magical memories of my childhood. Just, you know, riding the T, just the subway in Boston, riding the T into town and seeing a musical and then riding home and talking about it all the way home. Just me and my dad and musical theater. And it was just so special. And I'm so grateful for that. And I can't help but think that that is one of the reasons why I do this now.
What a gift. Do you remember any particular shows that you saw together that you really loved?
I remember seeing The Wiz. And I particularly remember it because there was a mistake and I'd never seen a mistake in professional theater, but the scene where the Lions tries to run away because he's so scared of the Wiz and one of the other, the Scarecrow holds onto his tail and he's trying to run away, but he's holding onto his tail. The tail broke and ripped off of his costume. And then so the Scarecrow had to stand there holding the tail to his butt for the rest of the scene, and they were all laughing, and the audience was all laughing because there's no way to hide and not acknowledge that this had happened. And I thought that was just the most amazing thing I'd ever seen.
You amaze me, Alika. It's been phenomenal talking to you. Thank you, and I love what you're doing with Stars in the House and your porch concerts and on and on.
So thank you, Gerald. That means a lot. I appreciate it.
I appreciate you. Stay safe.
You too. You too, my friends. Every day when lightning strikes,
it's the moment you know. The theme song was written by Tom McGovern. This episode was edited by Kyle Moore, and the talent was booked by Anna Stroud. When lightning strikes.
They say well-behaved women seldom make history. Just ask the Supps. A vibrant and wholly original new musical, Supps celebrates the real women who changed history and their story that is more timely than ever. See the show Variety calls an epic tour de force new musical, Deadline Cheers is a rare Broadway feat and leaves audiences inspired to keep marching. Suffs has arrived on Broadway, and not a moment too soon. Get your tickets today at suffsmusical.com. If you love Broadway gossip, you are not going to want to miss any episode of this podcast, Singular Sensation, The Triumph of Broadway. Plenty of dramas unfold on stage, but the best dramas unfold backstage. And there were no bigger dramas than behind the scenes of Sunset Boulevard.
So you were being crucified over here, but not there.
No. No, because I was turning in a performance that would get standing ovations. Excuse me.
So check out my podcast, Singular Sensation, for all the juicy and gory details of Sunset Boulevard.